Good afternoon. I'm Philip Lovell, Vice President of Policy Development and Government Relations here at the Alliance for Excellent Education. The Alliance is a national policy, practice, and advocacy organization dedicated to ensuring that all students, particularly those who've been historically underserved, graduate from high school ready for success in college, career, and citizenship. Today, we're going to discuss issues impacting undocumented students and their families. Specifically, this webinar is designed to provide information on the rights of all students to equal access to public education regardless of their immigration status. We'll discuss the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program, and the impact of the Trump administration's decision to end this program. We'll also discuss the DREAM Act and the importance of comprehensive immigration reform. Finally, perhaps most importantly, we'll be discussing the best practices for creating a culturally inclusive school environment for students and their families, particularly those who are undocumented or impacted by the ending of the DACA program. But before we get to that, just a few housekeeping items. Please follow today's webinar on Twitter using the hashtag DACA. To ask a question of our panelists, you can use the box below. And this webinar will be archived at www.allfored.org/webinars. Finally, to be clear, we'll be discussing complex legal issues, and the information provided by our panelists today is intended to apply to a broad audience. We won't be able to provide legal advice or opinions related to cases involving specific students or families. Now, let me introduce our guests for today. To my right is Carlos Guevara. Carlos is a well-respected attorney and immigration law expert, having served in senior positions in the nonprofit and public sectors. Currently, he serves as senior policy advisor at Unidos US, formerly the National Council of La Raza, where he leads the organization's immigration policy and legislative advocacy work. Before joining Unidos US, Carlos served in the Obama administration, where he worked on immigration reform from 2014 to 2017, and he was involved in the development and implementation of key administration immigration priorities. Also joining us is Jamie Fasto. Jamie Fasto is the principal at Education Council. Jamie has an impressive resume, having served in numerous leadership positions in Congress and in philanthropy. She previously served as Director of Policy for Education at the Emerson Collective. She was Director of Education Policy for Congressman George Miller, the senior Democrat on the House Committee on Education and the Workforce. She was a legislative assistant for Senator Patty Murray, and she was also here at the Alliance for Excellent Education. Thanks very much for joining us. Carlos, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And then remotely, we are inviting Eduardo Mendez to join us. Thank you for joining, Mr. Mendez. Mr. Mendez is principal of Guadalupe Centers High School in Kansas City, Missouri, a position that he's held for the past 12 years. Mr. Mendez has served in various capacities at the Guadalupe Center's Alta Vista High School since August of 1999. He spent the first 4 years as a social studies teacher, and then during the next 3 years, he was an at-risk coordinator working closely with parents of students who are on the verge of dropping out. Again, thank you very much for joining us remotely from Kansas City. We're going to get things rolling with a few questions to Carlos to help set the stage for this webinar, for the discussion. So we're talking about DACA. For those who are maybe just vaguely familiar with the program, can you tell us about what DACA is and what it does?
Sure, Philip, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here and to join your audience today. In brief, DACA, or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals policy, was a policy instituted under the Obama administration in 2012. And it allowed certain eligible youth, individuals that arrived to the United States as minors, to remain in the country legally. And the policy, which was mentioned earlier, announced in 2012, was implemented 2 years later, or sorry, 2 months later, and it allowed those to essentially receive a relief from a possible deportation and the opportunity to work in this country legally for a renewable period of 2 years at a time. At a very high level, there were several eligibility requirements for DACA, but for folks and for our purpose here today, some of the ones that come to mind here are the upper and lower caps, if you will. You had to be had entered the United States before the age of 16 and not have been older than 31 at the indicated time. You had to be showing that you were actually in school or would be attending school in the future. And importantly, folks had to submit to criminal background checks and ensure that there were not public safety threats to the United States. So that's in a nutshell what we're talking about here. And if I may, Philip, just a quick note about deferred action. It's a concept that sometimes gets lost, and it's something important to bring up. Deferred action is basically means it's a tool in the tool chest that any prosecutor, whether at the state or local or federal level, has in terms of organizing how they're going to move forward with particular cases. And basically what DACA did in the exercise of this discretion is to say, you know, we have a subset of individuals here that by definition are not threats to our community and that are attaining and they're achieving at great levels, they're going to school. And as a result, we're not going to focus on these guys. So it's a proper, it had been a proper, or should be seen as a proper exercise of that discretion.
Gotcha. So it's actually authority that already existed, and then this is a formal policy to apply it to this finite group of, really, of young people between the ages of 15 and 31.
That's absolutely right, Philip. And it's something that prosecuting agencies at the local level, at the state level, and yes, even at the federal level, use on a daily basis. So I think it's important to contextualize where the DACA authority came from.
Great. So tell us about who are the DACA recipients.
So it's an important question. And I think something that our audience should appreciate, we should consider, is that DACA was instituted and implemented in 2012, 5 years ago. To be eligible for DACA in the first instance, you had to have shown that you were continuously present in the United States for 5 years. So by definition, at a very minimum, the current population of DACA recipients has been here for at least 10 years. In many instances, it's much longer than that. Some of our friends over at the Center for American Progress and NILC did a comprehensive survey of the DACA population recently and found that about a third of the DACA recipients actually arrived in the United States before the age of 6. Two-thirds of them came before the age of 10. So we see, and the point being that this is a population that's been here for a very, very long time. Today, the DACA recipients, about two-thirds of them, are likely to be an average of 25 years old. They're still youngsters, but getting older, and life is moving on for them. And because life is moving on, they're more likely to be woven into our communities, have families. It's about 76% of DACA recipients either have a U.S. citizen spouse, sibling, or child in the United States. 26% of them have a U.S. citizen child in the United States. Longtime residents, have been here for a while, life goes on. These are American families in many ways.
A fourth of them have a child who was born here.
Correct.
And that's pretty incredible. Yeah.
And perhaps, if I may, of interest to your audience here today, and when we look at the education profile of folks, again, relying on the survey from our friends, 65% of these respondents are in school right now. And a number of them are pursuing undergraduate degrees, 17% of them actually going on to do higher education. And for those that aren't pursuing higher education, the labor force participation of the DACA pool is incredibly high. A high number of them, 76% of them, are in our communities, are in the workforce, participating at high levels in the workforce. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about DACA recipients.
Talking about, by and large, people who may not even remember the country that they were, you know, actually originally came from. So we know that the Trump administration has announced that it's phasing out the DACA program. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's no longer accepting applications, either new applications or renewals. The deadline for that was a few days ago was October 5th. So we're past that deadline. Mm-hmm. So now what happens?
Yes, we are past the deadline. And for folks who haven't been following this as closely, the administration on September 5th announced that they would be rescinding the policy, gave folks within certain parameters that were able to renew their application, or excuse me, whose work authorization expired between now and March to apply. They gave them a 1 month arbitrary, frankly, deadline to apply. you know, we as a community are still very saddened by the decision. There was nothing that was compelling the organization, not a legal requirement, not some sort of timeline that they had to abide to. This is a man-made disaster, and many of us are looking at
it. Yeah, we're facing enough actual natural disasters.
Yes,
to exactly. Put a man-made one on top of it.
So I completely agree with that. And, you know, a lot of our organizations, UNILOS US being one of them, have been very focused on making sure that folks who are eligible to apply did so within that window. And we're helping with scholarships to provide the $500, nearly $500 fee.
Because it's not free.
It's not free. Yeah. And $500, I'm thinking back to when I was 20 years old, that was a lot of money to come up with for a while. And what we've seen since that October 5th deadline is that about 85% of folks who are eligible to renew, Philip actually did renew, which on the one hand, and that represents, just for your audience, about 132,000 of the 154,000 or so folks that were estimated to be in that cohort. So on the one hand, we're encouraged that such a large group did renew. We're also concerned about the 15%. You know, at the time where we have large Hispanic populations in Houston and Irma that are Houston and in South Florida that we're dealing with Harvey and Irma trying to recover, we're concerned that some of those folks may have not been able to get their stuff together in time. Mm-hmm. And frankly, we're also concerned about folks making the calculus and say, why am I going to trust this government again to come forward? We made this big leap of faith in 2012. Why am I coming forward now again to provide my information? So. At this time, the sad reality is that for those folks, that 25,000 or the 15% that I mentioned, they'll start losing their protections between now and March 6th. That's a sizable population. Those are folks who work authorized, will begin to lose those protections and jobs and so forth.
And so say more about March 6th, another man-made creation.
Yes. So March 6th, another arbitrary deadline, correct, that was instituted. That's the date that a lot of our organizations are really concerned about. If Congress doesn't act, we'll see on the magnitude, our friends over at Ford US estimate about each business day, 1,400 DACA recipients losing protections. Each day, until folks eventually wind down from the program. You know, those families, we mentioned earlier, the 25% that have U.S. citizen children, the 76 that live with a U.S. citizen spouse or sibling or a child, that would have profound impacts on their livelihoods, on their families, and just general well-being. So we're really concerned about this deadline and are really hopeful that Congress gets this done, finds a solution for us.
And we'll get a bit to that. But before we do, so the group of young people who were eligible mm-hmm. for DACA in the first place was well-defined and actually fairly modest. So what happens to students who are not DACA eligible, and how does this apply to them?
So I think if I understand the question right, there was a cohort, and your audience perhaps knows this really well as educators, that when DACA was first instituted, were not immediately eligible. It's estimated that a group of about 500,000 in 2012 would what's known as age into DACA. So they were too young. The immigration authorities required folks to be at least 15-year-olds to apply. So in the last 5 years, we talked about 5 years have passed. Yeah. In the last 5 years, that number has gone down as people are eligible now to apply. But somewhere in the ballpark of 125,000 folks never were able to apply for DACA in the first place. And unfortunately, Philip, they won't be able to because the policy has now been rescinded. So in many ways,
and it's surely because of just deadlines that have been created by people. I mean, it's
absolutely,
surely not.
There is no legal reasoning. There's no there's no deadline based on fact that required the administration to act. It's pure politics.
Got it. So before joining UNIDOS US, mm-hmm. you were counsel to the Secretary of Homeland Security. So you've been in the trenches dealing with these issues for some time. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, otherwise known as ICE, is a component of the Department of Homeland Security of DHS. Can you tell us about the actions that ICE is allowed to perform on school grounds and what they're not supposed to be doing? And what kinds of information would schools be expected to provide to ICE? Mm-hmm. And what would they not be expected to provide to ICE?
Well, yes, you're right. I did work in the last administration from 2014 to 2017 at the Department of Homeland Security as a political appointee no longer there, and a lot has changed. And the reason why I mentioned that, the reason why I mentioned that is, I think, and it should come to no surprise to your audience and us here as we're chatting. We are living in a more complicated enforcement environment, and it's important that we understand that it's not just schools that potentially be singled out. It's a greater impact to the community, which many organizations like ours are very vigilant in making sure that we're pushing back as much as we can. In the school context, there are two things that I would mention. First, a policy that was instituted by the Department of Homeland Security that binds ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, from 2011, the sensitive locations policy, remains in effect. And it's policy that, as a general matter, has said that enforcement at sensitive locations like schools should be avoided, as a general matter. In the special circumstances in which ICE has a basis to do so, a supervisor, level approval is required before they move forward. This is ICE policy that's still in place. So your audience should be aware that's still in place and should be directing how ICE officials conduct their operations on the ground. The other piece that I would mention is that, while that's policy, there are certain legal safeguards that schools should be aware of that, in fact, direct how what information may be shared, or and frankly also what parameters within the constitutional protections that we all have, regardless of our citizenship, under the Fourth and Fifth Amendment, how far law enforcement can go, and those are in place, and shall remain in place. What I'll mention, Philip, is I think schools are in a uniquely situated to provide an environment where students feel safe, and I think part of that is to articulate, you know, what is within the parameters of enforcement, and a lot of organizations, I think some of us around the table here are working to elevate those issues.
Great, thank you. And we'll get later on in the program. We'll talk about the balance between the legal rights and then also just reality on the ground and how we can address those. So I want to turn to our friend Jamie Fasto for a moment. So according to the Pew Research Center, undocumented students make up about 1.3% of the K-12 population, about 725,000 students. Now these are students who are sitting in our classrooms right now as we speak. And there is Supreme Court precedent around ensuring that all students, regardless of their immigration status, that they have the right to go to public schools. Can you talk to us about this precedent?
Absolutely, and I also want to thank the Alliance for hosting us on this really critical and timely issue. So Carla sits here to allude to some of the legal requirements for schools and undocumented students. And the Supreme Court found, which is the most important aspect of the legal rights of undocumented kids in schools, that in Plyler v. Doe, that a student's immigration status or their parents' immigration status could not be a reason to deny them equal access to public schools. Importantly, that case was found under the Equal Protection Clause, and the court found that immigration status or non-citizenship did not undermine the equality provisions of the Constitution. What that means, though, in practicality for some of the issues in and around whether or not law enforcement can come on campuses, what information schools can share, is that schools don't need to know students' immigration status. That is not something that they need to be asking families, nor should they be, to uphold these equity provisions. And therefore, there is no information to be passing on to law enforcement about immigration status of their students.
Interesting. So in addition to Plyler, are there other civil rights laws that also protect these students that educators and schools should be aware of?
Absolutely. So Title VI of the Civil Rights Act prohibits discrimination based on race, national origin, and color for anyone who's receiving federal funds. And in the case of education, that is states and school districts. That also means there's no action can be taken to impede the rights of those students. So a lot of schools are embracing that aspect of not impeding this equal access by keeping kids safe in schools. And for this population right now, this means keeping them free of feeling that their campuses are a place where ICE could come for them or their families, and that nothing about their immigration status can impede their day-to-day life and education. I also want to underscore there is guidance that still exists at the Department of Education, along with the sensitive locations guidance at DHS, that outlines how schools should be interacting with these families and what they can and can't be asking of them.
Great. So Congress recently passed the Every Student Succeeds Act, replacing the No Child Left Behind Act. Are there specific provisions of that law that should be supporting these young people?
So yes, there are a couple specific provisions, but I would say broadly, given that under the Constitution, these populations cannot be treated any differently than citizen students or documented students, all aspects of law apply to these students, whether it's based on their disability status and rights, access to language services, homeless services, all of these aspects of the law apply equally to these populations. There is a provision in Title III, which is the program that supports English learners, that provides the opportunity for districts to use funds to support students and families from newly immigrant populations that are in districts where they've had massive increases or large increases. They certainly don't have to do it, but it is something that states can use. The other issue I would just want to highlight here to make sure the audience is aware of, what we just discussed is a set of constitutionally protected rights. There is nothing that this administration can actually do to undermine those rights. They could make it harder for schools, that's for sure. But there is nothing about the removal of DACA that undermines students' rights to attend school free of discrimination.
Thank you very much. I think that's a very critical point, that regardless of what the crazy that's going on right now in Washington and on this issue, students have the right to go to school regardless of where they're coming from. So where the rubber hits the road is in schools, in our classrooms. And Mr. Mendez, we're very pleased to have you here, and we'd like to draw you into this conversation. So first, can you tell us a little bit about the Guadalupe Center's high schools and the students that you serve? You've been there, you've been principal for 12 years, you were there for several years before that. Tell us about your school and about the students that you're educating.
Sure, thank you for having me on this webinar. And I'd like to share my perspective as a school administrator. The Guadalupe Centers, Inc. is a social service agency that's been around Kansas City for over 100 years, serving the Latino community here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our school is a part of the Guadalupe Centers, which is also an affiliate of Unidos U.S. and has been for over 30 plus years. But our school was originally started as a way to address the dropout rate among Latino students, which during the 1980s was estimated to be about 65%. So the high school was started in 1989. And since then, we've added a middle school, elementary school, and a pre-K program, currently serving over 1,100 students. At the high school in particular, we serve 396 students, and 94% of our students are Latino. 3% African American, 2% Caucasian, and 1% other. Our free and reduced lunch rate is 91%, and we have an ELL population of over 70%. We are a public charter school, and we are authorized by the University of Central Missouri.
Excellent. So are you seeing changes in student attendance or in parental participation in school as a result of some of the policies that we're talking about or some of the rhetoric that's taking place right now?
We haven't seen so much changes in attendance, but what we have seen is a change in our enrollment, particularly for our newcomer ELL students who are recent arrivals. For example, last year we enrolled 14 newcomers, English language learners, mostly from Central American countries of Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, really those who are fleeing some of the violence in their home countries. This year, we only saw three newcomer ELL students enroll, and it's directly related to the things that they're hearing, the rhetoric in Washington, what they're seeing on the news, but also because of tighter immigration policies and procedures, you know, being implemented around the country.
Got it. So when students are immigrating to this country, we know that often they probably have experienced a decent amount of trauma along the way. Can you talk to us about the trauma that you see in schools and what you're doing to address it?
Absolutely. Well, unfortunately, we do see many of our students who've experienced some of the trauma, particularly those fleeing from the violence in their home countries, just have a really hard time staying focused. You know, they experience difficulty concentrating, anger. We see irritability, mood swings, anxiety, fear. Some of them feel guilt and shame. And what we see is that they oftentimes they withdraw from their peers. We also see for some of our older students, juniors and seniors, when they start applying to college and they realize that there's some laws that have been passed specifically in Missouri that prevent them from going to college, they really get really numb and lose that excitement. And so we offer a variety of counseling services, both at our school and through the Guadalupe Centers, that focus specifically on trauma-informed care.
Excellent. So I want to turn back to some of our previous conversation and see how this applies to you and your school. Now, on the one hand, as Jamie and Carlos were saying, students have the legal right to attend school regardless of the immigration status. And in fact, there's policy on the books that is supposed to prevent ICE from operating unless they have a warrant and senior authority to do so. Enforcement activities on school grounds and other sensitive locations. And then there's realities and there's perception. So how do you balance creating a supportive environment at school with recognizing that that we don't want children and their families to be in harm's way?
So one of the things that happened at the end of last year at a local elementary school in a suburban district near Kansas City was there was an actual ICE agent that arrived at the school and questioned a young boy. In response to that, several urban school districts, including Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri, and our own school district, passed a resolution by the board of directors called the Safe and Welcoming Schools Resolution. And basically, this resolution was a statement made known to people that prohibits ICE agents from coming to the school, pulling a student out of class without a warrant. So there's planned training for our staff members on how to handle situations like this. But the thing is also what you talk about is what are the supports? That's one way to show parents that we support them. But what are the practical things that we have done to make sure that families and students feel safe? And that we support them. And we've done a variety of things in that end. Just most recently, after the decision to end DACA, we worked with our social service agency, Guadalupe Centers, coordinated some DACA clinics where students and families could come and get information and also help with the application of renewals. We held several Know Your Rights evening sessions for parents just to provide more accurate information and facts about what their rights are. And that's a way that we support our parents and students. Here at the school level, we do a thing called community circles. And both after the election and with the decision of the ending of DACA, obviously we knew that our students would be emotional. And so we do community circles where teachers really facilitate sessions where students can express their emotions, their anxieties, their fears, their questions, and it's just a way to support each other through that way. And so those are all ways that we help to support students and families to let them know, hey, we are here for you and we're going to do everything we can to support you.
And is there specific professional development that you give to your teachers and staff about how to address these issues for these young people?
Yes. In fact, one of the first things we do when we bring new people on board is to give them that history of immigration, the Plyler versus Doe, other things that they need to be aware of in working with our students and our families. So also we make them aware of the issues surrounding our community, specifically around immigration laws and DACA and what is happening. So we do that as part of our onboarding process with new staff. In addition to that, we provide ongoing PD for our teachers, updating them on current, you know, legislation, executive orders. We provide fact sheets so they can be informed. And again, this helps them when they go to facilitate these classroom circles with our students. About a month ago, we had a district-wide PD for all of the teachers in the elementary, middle, and high, sharing the latest information and also information about the DACA clinics that were being hosted to help students and families with the applications.
Great. So let's talk about what happens next. So these students and their families remain in limbo, and their future is actually really in the hands of Congress. And in the words of one senator, Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican co-sponsor of the DREAM Act, he said, quote, "The only thing that stands between you and certainty is Congress. That can't be reassuring." So, Carlos, I want to point a question to you. So, as we said, by phasing out DACA, the president has left it to Congress to pass a fix. And there's this deadline in March by when this has to be fixed before DACA students, DACA young people will lose their status. Can you talk to us about the DREAM Act, the legislative proposal line envisioned to address this, and what its prospects are for passage?
Look, Philip, you're right. The president did say that he was leaving it to Congress. I think, and I don't mean to belabor this point, I think a lot of community groups are still very concerned about the fact that such a decision, frankly, I called it earlier, a man-made disaster, was made in the first place without a timeline, without any specific legal basis to do so. So while he has pivoted to Congress, I think it's important to lose sight that this didn't have to happen. Not lose sight, that is, that this did not have to happen. But here we are. And we have to pivot to Congress, and we have been pivoting to progress. And organizations like mine and a lot of our partners, led by, frankly, the Dreamers themselves, have come forward and been very public about the need to pass a clean DREAM Act, which, among other things, means that eligible folks who came to the United States before the age of 18, who submit to criminal background checks, and show that they are pursuing higher education, ultimately higher education, going to serve in our military, or going to work, can have a pathway towards citizenship. And that's been our very clear position at this time. I think it's what we have been insisting on, and we will continue to insist on. You know, at this time, I truly believe that we have a window to do the, frankly, morally, economically, and politically correct thing. And it's all our jobs to connect with our members of Congress to make sure that they're hearing our voices. And when we see things like a White House staffer's wish list of all the nasty enforcement stuff that they would want in exchange, we need to keep in mind that this is a distraction. These are poison pills and time-used tactics that are intended to derail us from our purpose, our collective purpose. And it's not just the folks that you would suspect that are supportive of the DREAM Act. No, in fact, 75%, based on recent polling, 75% of Republican voters, including many Trump voters themselves, are supportive of finding a legislative fix that, by the way, contains a pathway for citizenship for these youth. So, look, I have faith in our institutions, in the American people, as I mentioned, who are behind this, that we can get to a good legislative outcome. It's just on all of us to make sure that the momentum is there and that we continue to have our voices heard.
And you mentioned something that maybe we can get just a little bit in the weeds on. You said that the goal is a clean Dream Act.
That's
right.
Can
you talk a bit about what you mean by a clean Dream Act?
That's right. What we have been focusing on, Philip, in our advocacy is pretty much a bill that recognizes that we're not going to hold our kids hostage to anything such as a border wall, ramped up interior enforcement. I mentioned earlier, right, that these are folks that are living in American families, right? They have parents that perhaps are undocumented. They have spouses that are American citizens. These families are complex and in many ways are kind of emblematic of America today. So when we talk about a Clean Dream Act, what we really mean is we don't want our kids to be held hostage for the passage of really nasty interior enforcement stuff. There might be a time where we can have the conversation about modernizing our comprehensive, our immigration system in a comprehensive way. But right now, we need to focus on finding a legislative solution for these children, and then we can focus on some of the other conversations.
We've created this problem.
Exactly.
That's absolutely right.
So, or rather, this problem has been created for these young people.
Disaster.
So now we need to come up with a fix for it.
That's absolutely
without
right.
Holding them hostage for anything else. But let's be clear, Jamie, I want to bring you back into this. Even if Congress does not act, regardless of what's happening, young people who are undocumented have the right to go to school.
That's absolutely correct. And that's based in the Constitution, it's based in Supreme Court decision, and it's based in federal civil rights laws. This is long-standing provisions and frankly underscores how entwined these families already are in our communities and are part of these systems. Interestingly, under Plyler, part of the reason the court found that immigration status should not affect equal access to education is because education plays such a critical role in participating in our society. And that was an underpinning of the decision. So again, regardless of the decisions around DACA or if the DREAM Act passes or doesn't pass, these students still have the right to attend school free of discrimination.
Excellent. And Mr. Mendez, a question for you. So as we've said that the DREAM Act is a critical piece of the puzzle, but in the grand scheme of things, it actually is just a piece. And that while Congress may feel compelled to create a path to citizenship for these young people, many of their parents could remain undocumented. What sorts of issues does this cause for your students? So even if they are technically legally allowed to be in this country, but their parents may not be, how does that tension play out in the classroom or in your schools?
Yeah, we do see instances where we have sort of mixed status families where maybe the younger siblings were born here in the U.S., but the older siblings were not. And we see that quite often. What we do to try to work with our students, I named a few things that we do for our older students, typically the junior and seniors when they're applying for college. One of the first things we try to do to make them feel comfortable to continue their dream is to figure out ways for them to get financial means to attend college. And that means looking at scholarships specifically that target undocumented students. And we started our, actually a current staff member and a former staff member together started a Pell Project, which is intended to give a scholarship in the amount of what the Pell Grant is specifically for undocumented students. You know, our goal and the parents as we work with them is if there is a situation where they are facing deportation and they're more likely to obviously take their whole family, but that we have worked with families where there are other members of the family who do have legal residency and have decided to leave their kids, in essence, splitting the family, which is not ideal. But we have seen families make those tough decisions. And, we do what we can through our agency, our parent organization, and our counselors here to help parents when they're facing those tough decisions. But we do everything we can still to keep that dream alive for our students. With the goal that there will be legislation passed and that they will be able to to fulfill their dreams and go on to a career.
No, thank you much. So before we go into some questions that have been given to us by the audience, and I do want to just have the reminder that if you have questions that you'd like to submit to our panelists, you can submit those in the box below the screen. Carlos, two final questions for you. So are there legislative proposals pending now that could create a legal path to citizenship for adults?
The short answer is no, at least not anything that I see meaningfully moving in anytime soon. And frankly, right now, we need to focus on this, what's at hand and finding a solution for these dreamers. So the answer is no.
Got it. So now on that point, if our audience would like to get engaged in supporting the DREAM Act, what's the best way for them to go about doing so?
So I want to tell a bit of a story here. When back from my days at DHS, look, I think
at the Department of Homeland Security.
Department of Homeland Security, correct. There's a lot of advocacy around a group of students that were fleeing violence in Central America, and folks that were going through their immigration process. I'll tell you what, the voices that I felt kind of eventually broke through in many ways were the voices of educators, of teachers, that had these students that were impacted in their schools. So I would just urge the audience here today, or if they know folks that are more inclined to reach out, to do so, and do so at the in-district level. You know, anonymous doesn't vote. So the more that we can reach out to our members of Congress and have the educator's voice, the teacher who has the DACA recipient in their classroom, or maybe the DACA recipient who's a teacher and is educating and has a classroom full of 20 kids that will no longer have a teacher. If we have those voices heard at the in-district level with our members, I think that would be incredibly powerful. My recommendation for our audience here today that wants to get more involved is to do that outreach. And then so doing, not just tell the personal story, but also convey the sense of urgency that we need to get something done now. And when we see, you know, again, a wish list, or we see things that look like poison pills to us, we know what they are. They're delay tactics. They're ways to kind of push this issue aside. I think that the teachers can have a very important voice in saying, this is who we are, but also we need to get this done now.
Great. So some questions from the audience. So Kate from Massachusetts asks, what protections are there for students with disabilities who are undocumented? Jamie?
So there are a few laws that protect students with disabilities and provide them their rights, which extend to services under the law. The Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which was passed in the early 70s, is the overall governing legislation that imbues most rights to services. Additionally, there's the Americans with Disabilities Act. Given how Plyler was decided and that citizenship or non-citizenship should not alter how you access education, all of those laws that apply to documented or citizen students also apply to undocumented students.
Great. So, Mr. Mendez, here's a question for you. This came from several members of the audience, and you alluded a little bit to this issue a few moments ago. The question is, can you share with us some of the strategies that you use to enroll students who are undocumented or who are from families with a mixed status and to make them feel comfortable continuing to come to school? And again, by mixed status, we mean families where one or two of the members of the family may be undocumented and the other members of the family may actually be citizens.
Sure. So, well, as part of the enrollment procedure, we do not ask that question. We're prohibited from asking the legal status of students when they enroll. As I mentioned earlier, when we find out, typically is when they're juniors or seniors and they're applying for financial aid and they realize they are unable to because of their status. Now, we do have great relationships with our parents, and they do tell us on their own when we find that there is mixed status, and that is in large part because of what we have done to support families and because we've been around for over 100 years. And so you know, we don't specifically have strategies for the enrollment process, but we do have strategies for is what do we do once we find out and how do we help them? And in this case, and particularly, I mentioned, we how do we get the financial means for them to be able to continue their studies after high school? And we look for scholarships, and we've started scholarships, and we've done other things. One other thing is we have a parent liaison who's a native of Peru. She's a former attorney. She works directly with our families and is able to refer them to other agencies or organizations that can help them with a variety of issues. We also offer parent education classes called Padres Comprometidos, which is facilitated by our parent liaison, but really serves the purpose of helping families navigate the American system of education and also what they could do to help their child prepare for college. But the key is really building relationships with parents and then implementing programs like Padres or other things where we can offer services for our families.
Thank you. Here's this probably goes without saying, but you know, it's hard enough to do well in school just regularly. The fact that, you know, Mr. Mendez, that you've had to create these systems of support in light of and in response to, as Carlos, as you've described it, this man-made disaster is just so unnecessary. It's just terrible. In any event, moving on. So a question for you, Carlos. So this, again, came from a number of viewers. So President Trump recently laid out some demands for any deal to protect the Dreamers. Can you describe what some of those demands are and your take on how this is impacting the negotiations around actually passing legislation?
So you're right. There's, since the time that we've had the decision to end DACA, and frankly, I fear the more that time passes, we'll have more of these. There's been kind of a wish list, if you will, of items that not just staffers at the White House or members of Congress have, but are generally gaining traction as well in the media, that really are focusing on two sets of areas. One is on this idea of border security, and then the other is on this general bucket of interior immigration enforcement. So there have been a set of issues on the border that focus on, your folks might be familiar with, the border wall and so forth, and on the interior, things that would essentially provide opportunities for immigration enforcement to round up and remove more people. The bottom line is, we find these proposals to be completely unacceptable. I think that first, and to a point I made earlier, we should not be holding our youth hostage to get these nasty provisions in place or trying to sneak them in. Second, let's see them for what they are. They are delay tactics that have been time-honored, if you will, in Congress, been used time and time again. And we need to hold our members of Congress accountable and demand that we move forward. And then finally, I would submit that if we were going to have the conversation about more broadly modernizing our immigration system, then we should do that in the proper time and context. This is not it. And those proposals are better left for that more comprehensive conversation. We're not there yet.
Got it. We've received a number of questions about advice for undocumented students with regard to higher education. So the question is, are undocumented students eligible to receive federal financial aid for college? And what advice for counselors would you have who are working with students on the FAFSA?
So Mr. Mendez referred to some of these challenges for this population. And no, undocumented students are not eligible for federal financial aid. There are a number of states, however, who have passed DREAM Acts and have their own sets of state versions of Pell Grants and other aid in which those students would be eligible, but that's a state-by-state issue. Students who did receive DACA do have appropriate documentation to be applying for financial aid under the FAFSA. Lots of states use the FAFSA for their own state aid, but it would be for those purposes. So for that population, they at least now have the appropriate documentation to be able to do so. There are other scholarships that are exist now and are growing for those populations. I think for school counselors and those who are working with students and applying to college, you just have to be extra mindful of where those states are, what those opportunities are to get them to and through college.
Got it. So a question from Sarah from Washington. This is, I think, Jamie, for you and for Mr. Mendez. So she says, I live in an area that's having conversations about protecting undocumented youth and in a district that's examining its policies. But there are some struggles at the building level. What thoughts does the panel have for practitioners as they're thinking about policy development at the building level? What do you see as blind spots and what should we be cognizant of? Mr. Mendez, would you like to go first?
Sure. I mentioned earlier that there was a resolution passed in some local urban districts, including ourselves. And the one in particular that our board of directors passed was called the Safe and Welcoming Schools Resolution. I would be more than happy to share that with whomever would like. But basically, this resolution just outlines the provisions that if U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents were to come to the school, how would we respond? And so there is, I think, the blind spots come when staff aren't aware of how to respond and they don't have the information or know what to do in handling those situations. So one of the key things that we are working on is to make sure our staff members know, our teachers and everyone else, how we handle that and ensure that we avoid those blind spots from occurring.
Yeah, I would agree with Mr. Mendez on the shared knowledge of the rights and responsibilities of schools in protecting these student populations is critical. You don't want those gaps in knowledge when we're dealing with these very uncertain times for these families. I would also urge folks to look at the Department of Ed guidance on PLILR and Title VI so that there's deep understanding of the rights of these students and the responsibilities for schools to educate these populations without discrimination. These, again, regardless of what happens with DACA, these are constitutionally protected and long-standing rights. The NEA and AFT have put out a lot of guidance for teachers on the rights of students and other supports that practitioners at the building level could certainly lean into. States also bear responsibility for civil rights enforcements with their districts, and so they could lean on their SEA to underscore the rights of those kids.
Great. So Kathy in Arizona asks, although you do not need to know a student's status, families often have a difficult time navigating district forms that allude to information possessed by documented residents. Are there tips for families on how they can navigate forms that request information they may or may not possess? Mr. Mendez, any thoughts?
I would definitely, most applications will ask, or most schools will ask for a copy of a birth certificate. And that could be an indication to school officials if students are born in other countries and have certificates from other countries. But again, I go back to there cannot be a question regarding specific status. And if parents are seeing that, to be able to ask questions, ask for help, or just ask somebody at the enrollment center to be able to clarify any of those questions.
Great. So, Carlos, a couple of questions have come in just about ICE. So how hard is it for ICE to get a warrant to pull students out of class?
This is a very interesting question that's kind of in some ways at the intersection of practice and the law. In other words, the law is changing a lot in this space. But the first thing to remember about immigration enforcement is that it is a civil it's in the civil space, it's in the civil context. So traditionally what that means is that, ICE doesn't require, or ICE doesn't usually operate in the same rules as, local law enforcement that usually were required to go and get a warrant based on probable cause and signed by an impartial magistrate, right? So ICE has their own constructs based on, and their own mandates based on, what the civil immigration law says of when a person is inadmissible or deportable, as the case may be. A lot of litigation in this space right now about what is sufficient for them to be able to go after an individual and whether it is required for them to have something that more closely approximates a warrant in the, if you will, traditional sense, in the criminal justice sense, that is signed by a judge. And what we need to remember is that ICE, this is all done through the executive branch, through the administrative process, and there is no, at this time, kind of process by which they can go to an judge, to get such a warrant. So there's a lot of litigation. It's an evolving issue. There's a lot of challenges around what is sufficient and meets the legal muster to satisfy the constitutional safeguards we have under the Fourth Amendment. But in short, I think they look at their priorities based on the civil immigration code and make determinations based on whether a person is inadmissible or deportable. These are kind of legal terms based on an INA, but I think this is what they're basing their decisions on.
As Mr. Mendez, though, pointed out, there are ways for schools to be planning for these situations so that there is a shared understanding about how to appropriately deal with them given a school setting. And the rights and responsibilities, again, that principals have for the safety and protection of their kids on a day-to-day basis, regardless of their status. And having police come into your school to pull a student out is causing trauma for the entire population. So there are districts who are creating MOUs with local law enforcement about these sorts of situations so that the warrant wouldn't be executed on school grounds. There are districts that are coming up with their own policies to tell their buildings to say, you need to send anyone with a warrant back to the central office, and we will deal with it outside of your school hours.
Right. So we're just about out of time for today's webinar. Before we close, I just want to give each of you the chance to say any parting thoughts. Jamie, why don't we start with you?
So I thanks so much for having us here today and having this breadth of conversation. Thanks to Mr. Mendez for what you're doing every day. But I would underscore actually what Carlos said about it's time for everyone to go act. This is there's too much uncertainty happening for these families now, and Congress needs to undo the man-made decision at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue and create some certainty for these families. I think it will be impossible to even get to comprehensive immigration reform until this issue is dealt with. And Congress can't keep kicking this can down the road. They need to solve this now.
Yeah. Thank you. So actually, why don't we go to Mr. Mendez? Any final thoughts from you, sir?
Yeah, just along those lines of advocacy, what can we do to advocate for our kids? And the key to us is learning which congressmen are on the fence and who can we write letters to, who can we email, who can we call, who can we tell our kids' stories to, and really encouraging our students to advocate for themselves, along with our staff and along with our families and the broader community. So I think the call to action is there, and we need to follow up and take action.
Thank you. Carlos?
I think my co-panelist summed it up really, really nicely. I think what I would add to that is this is a real issue. We're talking, your audience knows this, we know this, but our fellow Americans and our communities need to know this. Our members need to know this. This is a real population. This is not a theoretical, what if this happens? How can we potentially do this to maybe open the aperture here or close the aperture there? This is not theoretical. We have nearly 800,000 young people who, beginning March 6th, at the order of 1,400 each business day, will start losing their protections. The time is now. There's no excuse. We need to get this done. And I think teachers are in a unique position to tell some really important stories, either themselves as educators or teachers who have DACA recipients in their classrooms as well. So the time is now. This is a real issue.
Thank you very much. So let me thank our panelists, Carlos Guevara, Jamie Fasto, and Eduardo Mendez for being with us today. If you'd like more information on DACA, the DREAM Act, or additional resources on how to promote and protect the rights of students, we have links on our website to organizations and materials that might be of interest. Remember that this webinar will be archived at www.allfored.org/webinars. Again, the time is now. We have this man-made deadline by March 6th. Students will be losing their protections. You know, Congress tends not to do much without a sense of urgency and without a deadline. We've got both of them, but we can enhance that sense of urgency by phone calls, by requests for meetings with members, especially while they're at home. This is something that is just absolutely urgent and vital for us to do. I'm Philip Lovell for the Alliance for Excellent Education. Thanks very much for joining us, and enjoy the rest of your day.